Following weekend flooding, Governor David Ige, Kauai Mayor Bernard Carvalho, and military and county emergency crews took a helicopter tour of the devastated areas of the North Shore aboard a Hawaii National Guard Black Hawk helicopter. The governor and mayor flew over heavily damaged regions in the Hanalei district, including Wainiha and Haena, where they saw the swollen Hanalei River, flooded neighborhoods, and farmlands. Emergency rescue crews have evacuated more than 150 people by helicopter, 121 by bus, and others by water, and it's still an active search and rescue effort. Mayor Bernard Carvalho spoke with us following today's early morning briefing.
So right now, we're almost finishing to complete our search and rescue of the affected areas, primarily the Wainiha, Haena, and Hanalei areas. Damage assessments of public and private property. Now we're getting our assessments, food on the boots on the ground, per se. Guys getting out and doing assessment of the damage. That's a big part that has to happen sooner than later. We're out there. Looking at adequate relief, ongoing personnel, complete the restoration of power and water in the affected areas. We've experiencing some power outages and water outages because of that. But we're able to look at it and assess it and bring it back to at least a working order. Debris is a big part of clearing our highways and all of that, so we're looking at how we're going to manage that overall. And, of course, delivery of essential relief and recovery supplies to the isolated area. Now, as we speak, the Wainiha to Haena area, our people there are still isolated. They're not able to leave the area. That's a big concern for all of us. So what we've done is we've deployed helicopter evacuation operations. We've looking at, of course, Zodiacs, people who choose to leave and evacuate the area have done so via that route. We have others in our community who have stepped to the plate with jet skis and the like to at least support in that way. But then there's others who choose to remain there. And so that's another one that we have to address. And the ones that choose to not be evacuated, we've opened up Camp Nawi and the Hanalei Colony Resort, where we have all the water and food and supplies for those people who are not able to leave that area right now. And that still holds true for a while because of the massive rockfall and rock slides along the entire roadway area coming down from Wainiha to Haena. So that's been a big challenge for us on that part of the island. Our U.S. Army, our National Guard, the County of Kauai, we have airlifted over 220 people from the Haena, Wainiha area already. And, of course, they were transported to the Kilauea Gym. At least we have an area that they can go to right now. So we've been trying to assess that particular part of the island where they're isolated and working closely with our highways people to see how we can work very expeditiously to clear the area. But that's going to be a while because the landslide and the hillside, is the integrity is not solid, obviously. So there's some major issues with that. And then we move towards the Hanalei area. Those, at least the Hanalei area is open now. The bridge is open. People can come through the Hanalei town area. We're able to close and thus down our Hanalei school, which was the shelter there. And at least those people were able to leave the area. So, again, our immediate team here at the Emergency Operating Center, we have federal, state, county, Coast Guard, National Guard, everybody working collectively to address each step of the way. And that's the latest so far. We're asking everybody, we're also experiencing issues on other parts of the island, namely in the Kapaa area, Keapana, Koloa, who have been experiencing major flooding and damage to their homes. So what we're saying is if anybody out there who was affected by the flooding and the storm, to please contact a Kauai Emergency Management Agency at 241-1800. I really want to get that message out because others are also being affected, not isolated, but affected by the storm that came our way. And we're wanting them to understand where they can call so we can document their call and get them assistance accordingly. So that seems to be the overall game plan right now. Boots on the ground, assess the area, the damage, look how we can provide supplies and water and food to the isolated area of our island, and continue to evaluate, and we're close with our partners.
And Mayor, I recall the concern that we had following the breach at Coloco Dam.
Yes. Have we
had a chance to assess the condition of our dams and reservoirs? You know,
yes,
how is the Waita Dam, Waita Reservoir?
What we've experienced is just the high rise of water levels, but no breach as of today, as of now. But we're also monitoring our dams and reservoirs in that area.
Are you monitoring anyone in particular? I don't know about the Waita Reservoir or
Kalihivai. That's one of them, the reservoir up there.
And is in that fairly decent shape?
Decent shape. We have no immediate need to be concerned right now, but we are monitoring. The bright side, if you will, I mean, we have overwhelming support from just the community in general, people wanting to buy supplies, water, whatever, all kinds of supplies for people at the various shelters, well, Kilauea Gym at this point. And for the families who are isolated, so we're trying to really coordinate that to our American Red Cross and the food bank. So a big mahalo out to the families and the friends and the organizations and businesses who are stepping to the plate to at least get that part secured. But in the meantime, we got to get diligent with our partners in the state and federal and the county to really address each step of the way, because this is not going to be a short term. This is long term as far as we're concerned. And we're just going to address it accordingly to assure that the safety, and thank God nobody has gotten injured throughout this process, but at the same time there's major damage to homes, to property, to infrastructure, to facilities, county, all of it. It's just terrible. And this has been a very challenging time for all of us.
And Mayor, are there any care facilities or health facilities that might be experiencing shortages, or is there concern for folks that might be medically fragile?
Right. So those are the ones. Our first order of concern would be our children, our keiki, of course, our kupuna, and those who need medical services. We outreach to those so far. We've had a couple of them that we were able to evacuate and move out. But to date, nobody has called in on that. For the isolated areas, and of course the other areas, they can access the medical services as needed. But in this particular isolated area, that was our first order of business, to get to our keiki or kupuna. And of course the people need medical attention. So far we're okay with that.
Okay, but still an active kind of search and rescue.
Very active search and rescue still on board. Our military, our boots on the ground, like I said, are out and about. We have a police personnel who have been deployed as well, just to keep, you know, security and overall management of this area. Again, my concern is really how quickly we can get the roadways open. But from what we've seen, we did do an aerial helicopter view just yesterday with our team, and I was able to join them, and you can look it from the sky. I mean, oh my God, you can see the devastation along the roadways, and of course the erosion that is happening along the roadways could you know, pose some damage, of course, potholes and sinkholes and all that. We don't want that to happen. So my concern is how fast we can be resilient and repair those roadways so people can actually leave and not be isolated. So we have our waterways and our air helicopters and our Zodiac as far as relief efforts.
And Mayor, I know you were up there in the helicopter with the
yes.
governor.
Yes.
Any takeaway, you know, compared to what we saw with the Coloco Dam or with Iniki?
Yeah, from my point of view, it just, to me, it was one of the most terrible things that has happened to our island, especially on this side. I mean, there's still overwhelming flooding in many of our areas throughout the island when you look for the aerial view. All of our, of course, our turf fields and all of that, but the homes and the rivers and streams that are created were created through this, and coming to properties and to our park areas. There's no park now and no restrooms because it's just eroded away. And the water that came from, you know, from the mountains, of course, down to the sea is just amazing. And so that's something we're never going to, you know, forget, I guess, but at the same time, addressing it accordingly as a team.
All right, Mayor. Well, thank you for your time.
Okay. Mahalo. Aloha.
We also spoke with Red Cross Director Coralie Matayoshi, who was working with the county to help with the emergency shelters that opened over the weekend.
We had people at the Hanalei shelter, 40 people there on Sunday night. And then between 9 p.m. and 12 midnight, 21 more showed up. And I don't know how they got there because the whole place was surrounded by water. And so they must have come by on paddle boards and jet skis and boats in order to escape their wherever they were. So I think that they thought that they could ride it out, those 21 people, and they showed up at our shelter. The original plan was to have the Coast Guard and the fire department airlift them out by helicopter on Sunday, but with the weather, the helicopters were grounded, and so people had to stay another night. I think people just need to be prepared for anything. You know, it's always going to be unexpected, a disaster, but people don't think it's going to happen to them, and so they're not prepared. And I think people don't like to think about it because nobody wants to think of something bad. But people should be prepared at all times. Around hurricane season, people start thinking about it. But look at this. This is really flooding season, so people should be prepared all the time.
That was Coralie Mariyoshi, director of the American Red Cross chapter in the islands. And here in Honolulu, city officials are trying to determine if the damage estimates reach a threshold to be able to issue a disaster proclamation that would trigger low-interest loans to help people rebuild. The East Honolulu flooding did damage city property. City Facilities Director Ross Asamora says the flash floods underscore the need to be mindful to keep our storm drains clear.
The stormwater issue is one that we will continually be challenged with. And one of the issues that we have to understand better is how our weather pattern is changing. Talking to Dr. Fletcher and hearing some of his presentations over the past few years, we do understand that our weather patterns that we're familiar with are not going to be the norm for us as we progress in the future. What we saw during Tropical Storm Darby with a very highly localized heavy rainfall is what I understand that we have to anticipate in the future. And this latest example is just underscoring that.
We saw what happened with Darby and the freeway. This, you know, obviously Kalani Aniole Highway, we did see, I think, some boulders roll down way back when we had that really bad storm in the 80s. Any other takeaway, anything that we can do to prepare better?
Well, one of the things that did happen is during that flood in 1987, there were some recommendations that came from that. And so part of the improvements that were made to the drainage system in East Honolulu was the construction of some boulder basins. And the boulder basins were designed to actually receive the large boulders and rocks that created some trouble for the drainage system at that time. And from what we can tell by the assessment that was conducted as recently as this weekend, was that those boulder basins did their job. They did manage to harness all of those large rocks that would have otherwise damaged the drainage system more than what was damaged. Now our task is to clear those areas and remove all of that debris that accumulated.
So it probably could have saved lives because we were very fortunate that no one was hurt.
That's correct. And so we did sustain damage in the sense of flooding, but not to the extent that we saw in 1987.
Okay. Anything else that we can learn from this, just overall?
So overall, I think the real lesson here is that we have to be aware and sensitive to the fact that our drainage channels, ditches, streams, rivers, canals are not places to dump debris. When people trim their trees or do yard maintenance, it's not a place to dispose of their items. Thankfully, we did not see any large appliances or water heaters as we did during Tropical Storm Darby. But there's always that concern that if somebody that's irresponsible does do some illegal dumping, that it could affect the community at large.
That was City Facilities Director Ross Asamora talking about the flooding in East Honolulu. And just released today, a new emergency readiness report ranking states across the country. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation found that Hawaii fell short of the national average, but overall did make good progress since the last review. The report looked at six areas. In one area, healthcare delivery, Hawaii ranked better than other states. This morning, we talked to Anna Goodman Hoover, a researcher with the University of Kentucky College of Public Health, about our progress overall.
The National Health Security Preparedness Index is really the only tool we have in the U.S. right now to track a wide constellation of capabilities and activities related to health security and preparedness longitudinally, so over time. We've been producing the index here at the University of Kentucky for the last three releases, but it actually predates us, and there have to date been five releases of the index. So over that time, we've been able to track how well the nation is prepared to respond to public health emergencies, and we have found some interesting things in that time, including, you know, we're very happy that at the national level, we have seen improvement each year of the index. It's been slow improvement, it's been incremental improvement, but we are at a stage of 7.1 out of a scale of 10 right now. And that has represented about an 11% increase nationally over time. Now, because states face different kinds of hazards and risks, we don't really rank the index. We don't really rank states within the index because it wouldn't make a lot of sense to be thinking about Montana's capability, for example, for responding to a hurricane. But what we do is we look at the broad capabilities to respond to a variety of incidents, and some of those might be natural disasters or disease outbreaks or terrorist events, but how prepared states are to respond to that wide array of activities. And unfortunately, Hawaii is among the states that sort of fall below the national average, and it is by no means alone in that capacity. We do see wide regional disparities in preparedness across the U.S., with states in the Northeast having showing generally higher levels of health security than states in, for example, the Southwest or the Mountain West or other parts of the South. And Alaska and Hawaii both fall a little bit below the line for average preparedness around the U.S.
Overall, though, the progress has been good. That we've been making strides.
Yes. Hawaii has seen some improvement over time. Nationally, we have seen some improvement. And part of the challenge when you're looking at all of the states is that some states just improve faster than others. So a state might be improving in a given area, but at the same time still be not quite at the national average because other states are improving faster. In Hawaii, for example, you've seen improvements in an area of the index that we track called incident and information management, where we look at capabilities for deploying people and supplies, money, information where they're needed in the event of a large-scale emergency. And though Hawaii still lags the national average in that area, it has seen improvements over the years.
Right, and I'm looking at the figures. In 2013, we scored 7.4. This year, it's 8.2, and the national average is 8.8. So overall, we did pretty good in that area.
Exactly. And incident information management is really an area where nationally we are doing quite well. That is our highest scoring area of the index. So as I said, improving is terrific, and sometimes it's just hard to keep pace with that particular area because we have such a high score nationally to begin with. Now, other areas like healthcare delivery, we're not doing as well on nationally. So healthcare delivery is actually our lowest scoring area, and that's thinking about the resilience of the healthcare system in the face of an emergency. So how many, say, emergency medical technicians and paramedics do we have available? What percentage of the state lives near a trauma center? What percent of the hospitals have top quality rankings? So in healthcare delivery, we're really sort of lagging as a nation, but that's the good news for Hawaii because Hawaii is actually above the national average in that particular area. It's among the leading states in terms of healthcare delivery capabilities. And since that is an area of concern nationally, perhaps Hawaii has some opportunity to share its successes and help inform other states that are needing to move along in that area about what's working in Hawaii.
And the thing is, Hawaii has special challenges that most places across the country don't because we're an island state. And so when you consider the geographic challenges that we have to meet, the fact that we scored higher than the national average probably speaks volumes there.
I think it does. I think it really does. And when you consider that geographic challenge, perhaps it makes sense some of the areas in which the state could experience from learning from some of its peers across the U.S. And one area that comes to mind that could bring particular geographic challenges is an area we call countermeasure management, which is about the state's ability to store and deploy medical and pharmaceutical supplies that protect against diseases and toxic agents. So you might be thinking about vaccines, prescription drugs, masks or gloves or other kinds of medical equipment, and some of the challenges of deploying those kinds of equipment, those kinds of materials to an island state. It kind of makes sense that, for example, in countermeasure management, the state might be more challenged.
Right, and we did improve slightly over 2013, but still below the national average in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And one other area where we actually went down was health security surveillance. Talk about that.
Well, health security surveillance, what we mean by that is really how able is a state to detect and monitor health threats, to identify hazards when they start and spread. So what kind of a surveillance system for infectious disease, for example, do state health departments have in place? And are state health departments able to report and exchange surveillance-related information about disease with national databases? There are also issues of the kinds of tests that states can perform for infectious diseases like measles or malaria or even rabies. What are the capabilities that the state public health lab either has or oversees at another lab to make sure that there is sort of a chain of command there, that they are in the loop when threats emerge?
And one other area that you did look at was community planning and engagement.
Right.
We did make some progress there, but just slightly below the national average.
Exactly. And community planning and engagement is an exciting area that we've seen a lot of growth in over the five releases of the index. And what we're talking about with that is maintaining supportive relationships among not just government agencies, but also government agencies with community organizations and with individual households. And how are these different sectors working together to help develop shared plans that allow them to respond to hazards successfully? So when we're thinking about community planning engagement, we might be thinking about healthcare preparedness coalitions, you know, what different sectors are engaging in the work of making sure the medical system is resilient in a disaster. And we're also thinking about things like children and vulnerable populations. So are child care providers or kindergarten through 12th grade schools required to have disaster plans or evacuation plans or family reunification plans? So those kinds of measures really let us know how well governmental agencies are working with other sectors to advance health security.
And this report was originally developed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
That is correct. I believe they first began discussing it around 2011, 2012 and issued the first release in 2013. Then about 2 years later in 2015, after the second release, the production of the index moved to the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and we at the University of Kentucky have been the program office doing the work of building the index with many stakeholder groups. We have a national advisory committee of subject matter experts, many of whom you would recognize their names probably. We have work groups. We have a variety of mechanisms by which we bring people who really know about the world of preparedness into helping us think about, are we measuring it right? Are we looking at the right aspects of health security? Are there capabilities we're missing? And is there data out there that we really need that we're not getting right now?
Right. And all these reports and reviews kind of help give us maybe validation where we're doing things right.
Absolutely. I think there are opportunities for states to look at where they are performing really well and look at those strengths and share those strengths with other states. And then there are opportunities to say, where can we learn from other states? Where are other states really hitting the nail on the head here, and what can we learn from that?
That was Anna Goodman-Hoover of the University of Kentucky discussing the details of the Robert Wood Foundation's report about states' preparedness. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we continue our look at getting involved for National Volunteer Week. But first, your quiz. Since we've been looking at the funding on Kauai in today's program, today's backyard quiz will also take us to the Garden Isle. The Alekoko Fish Pond is a 600-year-old structure used by ancient Hawaiians to keep live fish in an enclosed area while allowing the water to cycle in and out. According to local lore, the pond was originally built by Menehune. Supposedly, one of the Kauai's ancient kings hired the Menehune to build the fish pond, who completed the project in a single night. Alekoko literally translates to rippling blood, and some say this is derived from the pond waters turned red from raw and bloodied Menehune hands. Though the proper name of the structure is Alekoko Fish Pond, it's also known locally by another name. Can you tell us the local name for the pond? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right will hook a reusable HPR tote bag. We hear a lot about the dangers of drunk drivers, and we might be hearing more about drivers who are high on drugs. That's the subject of the reality check from our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Chad Blair is on the line.
Hey, good morning, Catherine.
Hey, so tell us about this bill that's making its way through the legislature.
Well, this is from Courtney Teague, one of our Capitol reporters. And, you know, this comes actually, the legislation, from the Ige administration in the wake of those medical marijuana dispensaries finally opening for business and selling their product to qualified patients. The concern is driving under the influence of marijuana, that it should remain illegal and that it should be in statute. Remember, with marijuana, it's actually a Schedule I drug at the federal level, meaning it's illegal, along with methamphetamines, heroin, other drugs as well. There's even talk about adding, depending on which bill you're looking at, kava and even muscle relaxants that could impair your driving. So this is all part of a bill, a House and Senate bill with different versions, going into conference committee this week and next.
But you can't just, like, use a breathalyzer, right, to detect the different types of drugs.
I think that's one of the things that's been raised is, you know, how do you actually measure whether someone is stoned or high off some other medication? It's not as easy as you indicated with alcohol. There's even some concerns as to what actually constitutes the level of impairment. So these are the kind of things that they're going to have to weigh when they discuss this bill to see if they can work out a compromise. By the way, Catherine, caffeine and nicotine are exempt in this legislation. So for those of you who drink coffee and smoke cigarettes.
Now, it's also hard probably to prosecute, right? I mean, as far as detecting the level of drugs in somebody's body, don't you have to test your hair in some cases?
Yeah, these are the things they're going to have to figure out. But in fact, the bill does have support from the State Department of Transportation. Most of the county police departments and prosecutors are in support. But among those most prominently raising concerns are the Drug Policy Forum. While it's open to maybe having specific substances added to what constitutes driving under impairment, they're really worried that, you know, maybe what's more worrisome is drowsiness or distracted driving, right? People using their smartphones and whatnot. Should you, in fact, be working on that? And then what about things like antihistamines? Does that get factored in as well? How do you then measure that? So these are the kind of things that you've got to figure out. I should just add, most law enforcement officers are trained in recognizing impairment beyond alcohol.
Right, but the laws, I know it's tricky because keeping up with all the different things that pop up, you know, I mean, we've seen it with DLNR even, all the different types of thrill craft, and you have to, like, rewrite the rules every time, and that's a long process. So I'm sure it's the same with drugs.
And remember as well that many medical marijuana patients continue to work, contribute to society. They've got to get to their job. They've got to go buy groceries. Shouldn't they be allowed to use a car? So these are the kind of challenges that the lawmakers will have to work out.
All right. Thanks, Chad.
Sure.
That was Honolulu Civil Beat's Chad Blair with today's reality check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Across the state, various nonprofits were gearing up to mark Volunteer Week. Joining us this morning live from Kauai is Donovan Kananibibi, who's with the AmeriCorps Vista Program. Good morning, Donovan.
Good morning.
Quite a week you're having over there. I'm sure it's very different from what you expected.
Yeah. You know, Volunteer Week efforts have been going on, and with the storm that's come up, some of the attention that we've been giving to the other causes that we're lending aid to have been diverted to the effort to getting supplies out to the folks in Waineha and Haena.
Understandably, are any of your volunteers like trapped, though? Are they in areas that are isolated and have been cut off by this storm?
We do have some volunteers who are down on the other side of the road damage in Waineha, who are helping to organize some of the drops that are happening over there. So we're well dispersed and pretty well covered on the island as far as volunteers go.
And what was the plan initially? I mean, what have you had to divert from?
Well, initially we were looking to support our farm-to-table programs and the various farm projects that Malama Kauai has initiated along around the island. But under the circumstances, we felt that it was more important to divert the energy to those programs, to aiding our community. After all, that is what Malama Kauai is all about as a nonprofit startup.
We were talking with Mayor Carvalho, and I know he'd mentioned that there are a number of like taro fields that are underwater, and I'm sure there are farms that are in desperate need of help just because the floodwaters have just ravaged their farmlands.
Yeah, we've seen significant damage in the east side along the Kealia River. Most of the farms there have been pretty much put out of commission. Waipa is submerged underwater, so all of their operations are ceased for indefinitely. So we want to definitely support those folks. Right now, there's a lot of nonprofits and a lot of organizations pulling together to supply goods for the immediate needs. So with the amount of tonnage that's been delivered in the last 3 days, we're seeing that the immediate needs of the community are being met. Malama Kauai recognizes that there's a potential for a sustained effort to be maintained. And so we're putting our effort and directing our volunteers and folks who want to donate to kind of focus on that. Right now, we have a lot of donations. The Coast Guard and the Red Cross are organizing airdrops, getting that stuff all down to the other side of the road damage in Waineha and Haena. Malama Kauai has decided to turn its attention to collecting lists of the families and different individuals' needs. And so we're putting together boxes, naming those boxes, and organizing to get those things to those families, those specific needs addressed, because when the main drops are happening, those goods are being dispersed evenly throughout the community, so it's being shared. But we want to really put our effort towards helping the community with immediate needs and specific things that they might need.
We were talking with Coralie Mariyoshi from the Red Cross, and she was sharing that some of the folks, the volunteers that were at the shelters, needed relief because they were manning those shelters for, you know, a couple of days straight because they didn't have any additional support, and they were cut off.
Yeah, well, we've been stationed at Malama Kauai or at the Church of Pacific on the North Shore in Princeville. There's been two of us primarily there for the last 24 hours. The other person who's with me up there has been there for 3 days straight, and we've seen a pretty steady stream of volunteers coming in and out. So yes, the folks who have committed to staying are there primarily as the main people, and we're just fielding volunteers and sending them and assigning them to different tasks around the islands and helping with setting up and drop-off points around the island and getting those goods at those drop-off points to the main delivery centers here on the North Shore.
So you've got lots of helping hands, very busy hands, and by the end of the week, they'll be very tired hands.
It's actually quite astonishing to see the amount of love being poured out on our community, the effort from everyone out there, really humbling and really impressive to see so much effort going into this thing in such a short time.
Like
I said earlier, the sheer tonnage of goods and supplies that we're seeing really is going to make a huge benefit and aid in these people's struggle over the next few days and weeks. So we really want to focus on and bring attention to the fact that the road damage is so significant. This could take quite a while for our county to get the road repaired so the folks out there can come in and out. So at this moment, we're looking for anybody who might be interested in supplying us with boats where we can deliver stuff directly. Right now, the ocean conditions have come up, and so boat travel is kind of sketchy at the moment. But as soon as the weather conditions clear up, we'll be making boat drops and getting these things to the specific families who have sent us their lists of immediate needs.
Right, and we do want to make sure that all those helping hands and the volunteers are safe as they reach out to provide help to anyone in need.
Absolutely.
With regards
to the boats and whatnot, we are definitely screening folks and looking for well-qualified, experienced watermen to aid in that effort.
And are you aware, are any of your volunteers, are their homes damaged by the floodwaters? Any situation like that in your group?
Absolutely. A significant amount of folks out here have pretty severe flood damage in their house. We're collecting cleaning supplies for them to help them clean that up. And many of our volunteers are here just because they have no place else to go at the moment. And so we're helping them with getting through this time and giving them something to do so that they feel helpful. And then later on, as things settle down a bit and we get these initial drops out, we're going to begin to turn our focus towards helping those people with getting the rebuilding effort started.
Okay, all right. Donovan, thank you, and stay safe.
Thank you very much. Mahalo for your time.
That was Donovan Kabibi, project manager with AmeriCorps on Kauai. A new bus on Oahu's roadways is turning some heads. It's a second electric bus that's in use on the island. Earlier this month, the state announced it's testing out a different version at the airport terminal. We talked with Oahu Transit Services head, Roger Morton, about the goal to go with an all-electric fleet by the year 2035. Let's jump on board that bus and see what people think.
Is this the electric bus?
Yeah. It's an electric bus.
That's so neat. It's beautiful inside.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I like it.
You know, the seats are higher. It's easier to get up, especially here.
Oh,
you know. But I like it. Look at the wider walkway for people to get on and off. It's way nicer.
Yeah.
Wider door.
So I like that.
No, it's about the same. But look at the doors are way wider. Actually, it looks more roomy.
Yes, we have a bus from a company called BYD, Build Your Dreams. It's a Chinese company, and we're testing it this month. Last month, we tested a Proterra bus, And we are working with a third manufacturer to develop even a third bus. At this point, we're in a learning mode. We want our employees to learn how the bus works, our drivers, our mechanics, our management folks. We're in a real learning mode right now. We can see what kind of performances we can get from these vehicles. Will they save us money in the long run? All of those things are the mode that we're in right now.
And you're testing them out on different routes.
Yes, we're testing them island-wide, and that means that's a challenge for us, too, because we have to train up about 45 of our operators on the specifics of how to operate this particular bus. Now, it operates pretty much like a regular bus, but there are different screens. There's the concepts like state of charge, and there's other things like that. So our drivers require about half an hour of training before we can put them on a road.
And what's the initial feedback from bus riders?
From bus riders, has been positive. We've had a few comments about a few things, but it has been, most people are excited because it's a quiet vehicle. I mean, I think it's going to be huge for our little highly, dense neighborhoods that we can have a vehicle that is much, much more quiet than the vehicles we operate today. So that's that. My drivers have been generally very excited about the new vehicle, very supportive, and haven't heard anything negative about the vehicles yet. And frankly, it's exceeded our expectations.
And are you trying them on hills?
Yes, we're trying them all over. We're trying them on hills. We did have, these things are programmatically set up to try to conserve energy. And on one occasion, when we were sending it up a long grade on H2, it didn't quite perform the way we did, but that's something that can be programmatically changed. And we have one vehicle and it's sort of set for the mainland right now. And we have not tried to figure out the best pattern and the best settings for our island environment.
What about the capacity? Does it hold fewer riders or more?
It's about the same. I mean, we have about 37, 38 seats on a regular bus, and we have 37, 38, 39 on electric bus. So it's about the same size. One of the issues for us, and this is a little bit different, is range. Range on an electric bus is not quite as long and as durable as range on a diesel bus. And that has implications to the way we would schedule our employees to drive the buses in the future.
And then what about savings?
Well, there are savings from can come from really two sources. One place is energy costs, and we're using about 2 to 2.1 kilowatt hours per mile right now, and so if we were spending 20 cents per kilowatt hour, that would be about 42 cents. It costs us about 75 cents per mile for diesel. So that's one area of saving. Second area, which we have to see where it comes from, is in the area of maintenance. These vehicles don't have any oil, therefore you don't have to change the oil or the transmission fluid. Electric motors generally are much more reliable than diesel engines or internal combustion engines. And a lot of that will just come down to how well are these manufacturers putting the bus together, because traction is an important part of it, but there are other things too. Do the doors operate right? Are the braking systems, do they take as much effort, and so on? Again, so far we have been pleasantly surprised at how things have gone for us.
Right, but I'm sure there's also the question of, do we have the trained personnel to fix these things when they break?
Yeah, that's true, and training will always be an important thing for us. But we do have electric vehicles that are operating now. The difference is that our latest generation of hybrid buses puts a generator on the bus, but the bus itself is all electric. So our folks have been dealing with 500 volts systems for some couple of years now in our current buses. This is, if you look at it, this is like replacing that onboard generator that we use now with diesel with batteries. But beyond that part, the rest of the bus looks pretty much the same. It's electric motor, Electric air conditioner, electric doors, all of those things we've already gone through them with our hybrid electric buses.
Right. And we used to have electric streetcars way back when.
starting in 1901, we had electric streetcars. Last one came out in 1941, just before the war. After that, we had electric trolley buses. Those are rubber-wheeled vehicles that ran on two wires, overhead wires, and those went out in the 50s. So we've had a long history, a rich history of some electric vehicles, and I guess things come around and they come around again and again. So now I think what's changed has been battery technology, and this is a game changer, is this the new technology batteries that have been developed. Some of them lithium ion, that's what our Proterra bus was, lithium iron phosphate, that's what the BYD bus is operating on. But it's the battery technology that has enabled us to get to where we're at right now.
And then you mentioned that this particular bus was manufactured by a Chinese company?
A Chinese company, but manufactured and assembled in California. This BYD is by far the largest manufacturer of electric vehicles. In fact, in Shenzhen, there are 16,000 vehicles in that one region alone, 16,000 BYD electric vehicles. So it is by far the largest manufacturer of vehicles. The American companies, Proterra and the other companies, are definitely in catch-up mode. Part of that is because in America, we just don't have the demand for public transit buses that they have in China. So that's been a factor. But I would say across the country, in almost all cities, they are now beginning to look at electric vehicles because they're now possible.
And are there any issues related to the union as far as switching over to these buses and any training that might have to undergo?
Well, we've obviously met with the union a number of times to get their input about how this has happened. The unions normally would look toward their member employees to see if there were issues. So far, I'm not aware of any issues that have come up over electrification of that. I don't expect any. And so far, I guess the mode for most employees is excitement at this point. But I haven't heard anything negative at all from the union.
Okay, so the question still remains is then the charging infrastructure in order to get these buses juiced up.
Yeah, and that'll be a huge, huge issue because we have 550 buses right now. That's probably onboard storage about the same as the island of Kauai. So, I mean, it is a lot of energy. And to get all that energy to the right place and all at the right time and to do it, will be a monumental task. And there are really two modes of operation for these vehicles. One of them is called opportunistic charging. And that is, if you can envision it, the bus goes back and forth, and at the end of each trip, when the driver takes a break, it gets charged right there for about 10 minutes. And then that's good for about another hour of operation. So that's one mode. The other one is what is called depot charging, which is the bus is charged overnight usually, or for a longer period of time. And we need to sort that out. You know, we do have some opportunities in Honolulu. One of them would be to partner with HART and with rail. So a lot of our bus routes are going to change with rail, and they'll be focused on rail stations. So we've been talking to HART about how we can best prepare some of the rail stations so they could support charging and electrification of buses. One of the nice things about doing it that way is that we want to maximize the amount of time that we charge buses during the day. Why? Because we have all of that abundant solar radiation, solar power. And in our partnership with Hawaiian Electric, the utility tells us that we'll get our lowest rates during the daytime hours. And further, they'll be able to better meet their goals for trying to switch to 100% renewable electric infrastructure. By allowing additional solar power on the rooftops and in their utility scale plants. So it's a win-win for both the utility and for transit in Honolulu.
Right. So for bus riders, they saw one type of bus a couple months ago. There's a new one on the road now. They'll be on the road for the next month and maybe a new one down the road as well this summer.
I think that probably the next time we'll probably be, I'm sure that we will be looking at purchasing some buses after these tests are done, and to help, you know, we're again trying to learn what works best for us. We need to take some small steps at first, but we have a pretty aggressive schedule going forward.
That was a quick test drive on a new electric bus on the road. We were chatting with Roger Morton of Oahu Transit Services. He wants to know what you think of the ride and asks you to call the bus to share your thoughts, or you can go online and give feedback to customer service. That electric bus will be in service for about a month. In today's backyard quiz, we asked you if you knew the name, the local name for Alekoko Fish Pond. Legend has it the pond was built by Menehune, hired by one of Kauai's ancient kings. Constructed in a single night, the Menehune passed stones hand to hand from 25 miles away. This extensive project took its toll on the Menehune's hands, and upon completion, they rinsed their raw and bloodied hands in the pond, turning the water red. The proper name for the pond comes from Alekoko, literally means ripping blood. But we asked for the local name, and that's where the Menehune get their credit for such craftsmanship. Kauai locals refer to Alekoko Fish Pond as Menehune Pond, recognizing the mystical little people for their hard work. And we have a winner from Kahala. Haruo Oshiro got that answer right. And that is today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Tomorrow, we sit down with Ernie Lau, Chief Engineer of the Honolulu Water Supply, and we'll be taking your calls about the proposed water rates. Tell us what's on your mind. Call our talkback line and leave us a comment. The number to do that is 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of this show or want to pass one, check the conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under talk shows for The Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.